James chapter 4. Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow, we'll go to such and such a town and spend a year there, doing business and making money. Yet you do not even know what tomorrow will bring. What is your life? For you are a mist that appears for a little while and then vanishes. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wishes, we will live and do this or that. As it is, you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil. Anyone then who knows the right thing to do and fails to do it commits sin. What is your life? It's a great question. Maybe a difficult question for New Year. What is your life? It's not something that we're always spending a lot of time thinking about. Maybe you could ask, do I have goals or purposes for the year ahead? Have I made plans? Are there opportunities or moments that I would like to seize this year? Do you have values that guide your choices? What is your life? James's answer in his letter is that life is brief. In verse 14, he says, you are a mist that appears for a little while and then vanishes. Like boiling water in a kettle. The water vapors there and then it disappears again and it's gone. As a teen, I never saw life that way. I never really thought much about it in my 20s or in my 30s. But 60's only a little way away. Now I know you can't believe I'm approaching 60 because I look so young. The secret? Face cream. Anyway, to the point. My birthday comes in a couple of weeks' time. I'll be 58, just 3 years younger than my mum when she died. It makes me think. I heard of a guy way older than me and his finance person was trying to get him to invest in something that she didn't want to do. And he did the green bananas thing. Son, at my age, I don't buy green bananas. Reality sets in. Most of the time we think about the frailty of life only at the funeral of somebody we love or care for, or somebody's got really sick. Because our truth is that we live in a society where the medical community can extend our lives and improve our quality of life. I've got the best neuro team I could ever imagine helping me, and I'm grateful for our healthcare system. But in the time of the biblical writers like James, there was nobody really to help in that kind of a way. But there are occasions that do make us think about life, not just a funeral, kids moving out of the house, losing a job, somebody getting a bad diagnosis, a forced relocation. All of those things can make life seem a little too brief. Maybe that's why in our culture we focus on extending life as long as possible with the best possible healthcare we can. We don't want to have a time limit. We want to break through it. Maybe that's why we focus on packing so much fun and pleasure into everything we do. We want to make the most of the time that we have. Maybe that's why in our society we focus so much on our appearance, because we don't want to look as though time is running out. And here's my pet cat Clover coming to help with the sermon. In the movie Casualties of War, Michael J. Fox plays a man called Private Erickson, a soldier in Vietnam who's part of a squad that abuses a young woman. He doesn't participate in the crime, but he struggles with what happens. He says this, just because at any second one of us might be blown away, we are acting like we can do anything we want as though it doesn't matter what we do. But I think it's just the opposite. Because we could be dead in the next split second, we got to be extra careful about what we do. It matters more. Maybe it matters more than we know. Maybe there's part of us that is all too aware of the brevity of life. What is your life? It's brief, and it's uncertain. How do we respond to that reality? We plan and we organize. Verse 13, come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we'll go to such and such a town and spend a year there doing business and making money. There was lots of travel in the first century. People actually did move around in the ancient Near East and Eastern Europe. They traveled a lot, and mostly on business as well. They wanted to succeed. And it means really James could have written to us and said, now listen, those of you who say, this year I'm going to go to university for 3 years, and after that I'll go into this career. Or in the next 2 years I'm going to start a family and we'll have so many children. Or perhaps those that will say, in one more year I'm going to retire, I've got a plan. In other words, he's not so much talking about money or business or children or grandchildren. He's talking about the normal things that we do. Exercising control over our circumstances and planning ahead, because life is uncertain. Tomorrow I'll do this, next year I'm going to go to Europe, the year after I'll, well, whatever. It's normal to talk about those things. There's nothing wrong with any of it. Today or tomorrow we'll go to this city, that's a place. We'll spend a year, that's a time. We'll make some money, that's my purpose. Setting goals, making plans, we're always doing it. And it's just fine. I had to do it today. I had a place to be, here. I had a sermon to preach, right here, right now. We do this sort of things. Is James saying then we shouldn't? Not really. He says today or tomorrow we will do this or that. It would have been much easier if he'd just said, but look here, as followers of Jesus, stop talking like that. Stop making plans. But it's not actually what he says. Look at what he says in verse 15. He says, instead you ought to say, if the Lord wishes, we will do this or we will do that. It's a fundamental difference between doing life the ordinary way, whatever I think today should be about, and ways that God would have us to live. He's saying the normal way we go around is a little misguided. Misguided because he wants to point us towards God. So is that it? We should just preface everything we say with, if God wills. If God wills, I'll go and get gas for my car later on today. If God wills, I'll pick up a turkey and we'll celebrate Christmas. If God wills, I'm going to look for a new job next year. Is that it? A kind of a magic formula? Some of us actually try that at times, I think. We sprinkle a teaspoonful of Jesus over everything. The way kids in Holland would sprinkle a teaspoonful of chocolate sprinkles on their toast in the morning. We do it sometimes by saying things like, God told me. Although sometimes that's just a way to end a conversation. Or we say things like, I've got a word for you. Really? How do I know that? Are you sure? Or are we just trying to bully people? Or perhaps avoid responsibility for our own words or our own actions? This doesn't seem to be what James means either. Look at verse 17. He says, anyone then who knows the right thing to do and fails to do it, commits sin. Now, when I first looked at that, I thought, that's awkward. It's confusing. It's like a proverb that doesn't seem to have very much to do with this planning for the future, thinking about a new year. What's he getting at? But it was the little word then that caught my attention. Anyone then. He's making a connection. But what is it? What's he saying? What he's saying is there actually is a sin that is so big we can easily commit it. And we don't even know we're doing it. We're oblivious. It's huge. It's pervasive. And it's so easy to do because it doesn't require you to do anything at all. You commit this sin by just going with the flow, bobbing along in the river, going with the crowd, doing what everybody else is doing. You commit this sin by not doing anything, by not exerting yourself, by making no effort whatsoever. You just do what comes naturally. And when we do, we're in danger of this sin. Well, that's cheerful for New Year. A happy New Year to you too. But what is it? It's going about life, building a schedule, making our plans, having goals, but not thinking about God. Just not bringing him into the equation at all. We're forgetful. We forget about him. That's really what he's talking about here. One of the worst things that we end up doing in our life is making plans and having goals and setting time limits and directions, and we just forget about God in the whole process. Life is uncertain. And we need to plan. There's nothing wrong with any of that. The big issue is not planning or having a schedule or having a goal. The big issue is forgetting God in the process. We leave him out of our equations. We make our plans independent of him. We live life independently of him. We deal with the uncertainty and fragility of our lives independently of him. And when we make our choices like this, something has gone wrong. In verse 16, James actually calls it arrogant and evil. Those are strong words, but he's reminding us that when we choose to live independently of God, when we choose to make our plans and forget about him, it's a terrible thing. And here's why. Do you know what it feels like to be forgotten? Maybe your birthday came and went and nobody bothered. Nobody said anything. I'll never forget the day I came home work from late. I'd forgotten something. I came home and discovered there was a special meal at home. The tablecloth was out, there were fancy cupcakes, fancy glasses on the table. It looked like a spectacular meal had been prepared. It turned out it was the 25th anniversary of my very first date with Gillian. Not only did I forget it, I could not have told you what the date was. And to make it worse, I had brought someone home from work with me to the anniversary of this. My wife is a living saint putting up with me, but we've made it for 35 years and we're going to try and keep going. Forgetting things? It's easily done. Your name isn't on the invitation list. Nobody chose you for the team. You were left like a wallflower at the dance with no partner. Everyone goes out for the evening and nobody thinks to invite you. What's it feel like? Like you're not wanted. That you're being ignored. It's worse than being criticized. It's being forgotten. And James says this is how God feels when we structure life independently of him. It's not just about using the words God willing to make our plans seem a little more spiritual. It's about remembering to remember God in every aspect of our lives. In Psalm 9, it's interesting to think about being forgotten. Psalm 9 verse 17 says this, "The wicked shall depart to Sheol, the place of the dead, all the nations that forget God." Who are the wicked? The people who forget God. It's as though God's saying, if you forget me, you're going to end up being forgotten yourselves. Those who forget God will be forgotten. And those who remember God will be remembered. There's another Old Testament picture of forgetting. In Jeremiah chapter 2, verse 32, we read this. "Can a young woman forget her ornaments, or a bride her attire? Yet my people have forgotten me, days without number." Now, I've done a lot of weddings with a lot of mishaps. A ring-bearer puppy who ran away with the rings as the wedding was starting. A bride who fell down the amphitheater stairs, a best man who collapsed on the floor drunk just as he was about to give me the rings. I could write a book about all this sort of stuff. Maybe I should. But in all my years of officiating weddings, I've never had a bride stop halfway down the aisle and go, "Oh, I forgot my makeup." It's never happened. It's never happened. Why? Because it's her wedding day. It's one of the most important days of her life. She wants to be her best. And God is saying here, we remember the things that are important to us. So when we forget him, then obviously he's not important to us really. We might think he is, but our actions say something else. That seems to be the logic here. And it's not only that we offend God by forgetting him. We hurt ourselves. We actually hurt ourselves. What exactly is worry? It's our concern, our anxiety about being able to control the future. It seems out of our hands. And if we can't do anything about it, we worry and make ourselves sick. It's the reality that life is uncertain and that we are not God. We know we can't control everything. And so we worry. What will be the results of my medical test? How will my exams go? Will I still have a job? How high are interest rates going? I need to renew my mortgage. Does she really still love me? Will we have enough money in our savings account? Will I be able to find somewhere to rent this year? Will I ever find a partner? How are my kids going to turn out? The list is endless. We worry and it eats us up. And we make ourselves sick. We hurt ourselves with worry. We hurt ourselves too with pointless comparisons. Sometimes we feel like complete failures. Mostly because we compare ourselves to other people. We look at them and go, look at all these other people. They've got a great career. Look at them. They can afford a house. Look at them. They were able to go on an overseas holiday this year. Look at them. Life never seems to take a wrong turn for them. It always works out. Do you know why we're so hard on ourselves, really? It's forgetting God. That's what we're doing. It's a mistaken belief that these people seem to have made it all by themselves. And they're obviously better than me. And I'm worthless. I'm useless. I don't count. It's this forgetting God out of the equation and trying to compare everything by ourselves. That's the reason we're jealous and the reason we're worried. And what will the alternative be? It would be to remember. Have you ever gone looking for something and you can't really find it? Or maybe you can't even recall what you were looking for? We all get memory lapses like that at some time or other. Stopped in the doorway of a kitchen, perhaps, or some other room and wondered, was I going in or coming out? Or maybe you've stood in a closet wondering why you're there. Was I hanging something up or was I taking something out? I don't know. Or maybe you met somebody and you should know them real well and you can't remember their name. That's happening to me now, the older I get. Or maybe you go to the grocery store. There's one thing to get. It's worse at Costco doing this thing. There's one thing to get. You come home with dozens of things and you forgot the one thing you really were supposed to get. That never ends well. Those are the kind of memory problems that we all suffer from. They're humorous at times, frustrating or annoying, but we know what they are. But there are some poor souls for whom memory loss is way worse. One of the most dreaded diagnoses that you could ever receive is of Alzheimer's. It begins subtly, but very soon those that are struggling begin to lose memories quickly, even of who they are or who their loved ones are. Sometimes it's long-term memory that disappears, memories of childhood, and we can't recall anything about our past. Sometimes it's very recent memories, short-term memories are gone, and people can tell you stories from the past, but they're going to tell you it again in another minute's time because they don't remember they've just spoken to you. Maybe you ever once watched the movie Still Alice. Alice Howland, a linguistics professor at Columbia University. She celebrates her 50th birthday with her husband John, their three adult children. But she forgets a word in a lecture that she's given. She gets lost when she's out running. And quite soon she's been diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's. Alice's memory fades, her disease advances. She ends up having to give up her job that she loves because she's not able anymore. At her doctor's suggestion, Alice actually gives a speech at an Alzheimer's convention about her experience with the disease, using a highlighter pen to highlight as she's going so she can find out where she is on the page and not get lost because she couldn't remember what she's just said. She received a standing ovation. And the point of the whole story, despite her memory challenge, she's still Alice. Or maybe you watched the movie The Notebook, the story of two young people, Allison and Noah, a summer romance that ends up in true love. The journey's less than straightforward, but they do make a life together until the onset of memory loss. Allie writes her story in a notebook, and each day Noah goes to the nursing home where she is, and he reads to her from the book. You know why? It sometimes jogs her memory, and she can remember for just a little bit, maybe only for a few minutes, but for a few minutes they're together again. And on the flyleaf of the notebook, she wrote this for him. Read this to me and I'll come back to you. If you've watched the movie, you're as soft as me, and now I'm going to start crying making this video. If you're as soft as me, you probably cried at that point. Memories are powerful things. So what do we need to remember at this turn of the year? To remember that there's a God and we're not him. To remember that he cares for us. To remember that he provides for us. To remember that he loves us. To remember that he'll never leave us or forsake us. To remember that whenever we face real trouble, Jesus says, he has overcome. So what if we would say something like this? I'd love to get into this school, or I'd love to marry this person. I'd love to move to this new house. I'd love to have this opportunity. I'm praying for them. I've set a goal, but I don't know. I'm going to trust God that he will be my provider and he'll direct me into the best possible future that he can for me. I don't know what's best for me, but God does. And even if it's hard, he'll be with me. I think if we approach life that way, we'd be actively remembering who God is and his place in our lives and in our world. We're remembering God. It's not a trick. It's not a turn of phrase. James is trying to say that in every moment when you're facing choices or decisions, remember God. Remember his grace. Trust him. You see, remembering is not like trying to get as many facts or figures right about God as though there's some sort of final exam you have to pass. That's not the deal. Really, we're reminding ourselves to depend upon him. remembering is all about dependence. Sometimes when we're encouraging somebody to do something, we ask them to try to get them to remember something as a way of pressing on. Kids have got a tough test at school, and we remind them that the last time they faced a situation like that and they studied hard, it worked out okay. We use it to encourage them, you could keep on going. Or maybe it's encouraging a mum of the overreactive toddler that if she's survived 30 hours of labour, she can keep going with this kid. It'll be okay. I'm a guy, I shouldn't talk about that. When I'm at the dentist, though, and I'm terrified of dentists, when I look at the clock and watch the minutes going ever so slowly, I can remind myself, if they could screw things into my heart when I was awake, I can get a hole drilled in my teeth. It'll be okay. Past accomplishments help us push forward. But James here is not trying to get us to remember what we've accomplished. He wants us to remember what God has accomplished. Kind of like Moses did with all the people of Israel when they left Egypt and were ready to enter the promised land. In Deuteronomy chapter 8, Moses' kind of farewell speech or sermon to them, he said this, "The entire commandment that I command you today, you must diligently observe, so that you may live and increase and go in and occupy the land that the Lord promised on oath to your ancestors. Remember the long way that the Lord has led you these 40 years in the wilderness in order to humble you, testing you to know what was in your heart, whether or not you would keep his commandments." In fact, to drive the point home, Moses reminds them of their inadequacy. When God brought them out of Egypt, they didn't have what it would take to make it through the desert. They couldn't have done it without him. And isn't that your story and my story, really? When we were far from God, when we didn't give God a second thought, when we were doing our own thing, Christ died for us. We couldn't make our situation right with God. There's not much we could get into. The slavery we were in wasn't in Egypt. It was to our selfish desires and to sin that we couldn't break free from. All of us living for ourselves, trapped in a little world of our own making. No way out, but God loved us and gave his son for us. If we only would believe, he could rescue us and set us free. God remembers. He remembers us. You're not forgotten. Having a relationship with God, it begins by recognizing our own inadequacy, confessing our sin, including that we easily forget God. Just tell him you do. Repenting, turning around, placing our trust in him, because he remembers you. Maybe today you've never even made a decision to follow Jesus. Maybe today, at the beginning of this year, could be your moment to do just that and to say, "I remember. I'm going to trust you with everything that's still to come." And for those of us who have chosen to follow Jesus, perhaps we can choose to remember as we worship, because worship is all about memories and remembering. We recall God's mighty acts, the Exodus, the promised land. We recall the birth and the life, the teaching, the miracles, the death, the resurrection of Jesus, his ascension on high, the gift of his Holy Spirit that he poured out upon all of us. We remember in our songs and in our prayers, in our Bible readings and in our stories, in our dramas, in our testimonies, in our videos. We remember God. I don't know about you. I just know how easily I forget. And I forget more the older I get and the sicker I get. I forget things in my shopping list. I forget phone calls. I forget an expression of gratitude. I forget people's names and faces. I easily forget God in my life. I know I do. That's why I'm grateful for this invitation to remember that comes to us. It's an invitation at the start of this year to remember Jesus.